This is oral history interview number 40 with Dr. Charles W. McLaughlin. Dr. McLaughlin received his Bachelor of Science in Medicine from the University of Iowa, Iowa City, Iowa. In 1929, he received his medical degree from Washington University in St. Louis, Missouri. He interned at Montreal General Hospital in Quebec, was a resident of pathology in McGill University, and a fellow in surgery at the University Hospital, University of Pennsylvania, Philadelphia. He was the traveling fellow in surgery and went to the University of Edinburgh in Scotland. He has been certified by the American Board of Surgery in 1940 and has been in the private practice of surgery and on the teaching staff of the Department of Surgery of the University of Nebraska Medical Center from 1935 to the present. Dr. McLaughlin, I noticed that your father was an MD. Is this what decided you to become a medical doctor also?
Basically, that is the reason that I did enter medicine. My father was a family physician, family practitioner in Washington, Iowa, a town of about 4,500. And I started going with him on his country trips at the age of six, carrying his bag, and continued to do so all the way through secondary education until I went off to college. I really didn't seriously consider any other field of work other than medicine from early childhood.
I see. And I noticed your degree at the University of Iowa was Bachelor of Science in Medicine.
I took my liberal arts education at Iowa, and at that time one could get into medical school with a limited number of hours, so I took 2 years of academic work in liberal arts at the university and an additional summer to get off some requirements.
I see.
And entered medical school at the end, really, of 2 years of college work. Therefore, I was able to obtain a degree, Doctor of Science, at the end of my second year in medicine. I left the University of Iowa after my first 2 years in medicine because the spring of my sophomore year, they had a very unfortunate political upheaval in the faculty, in which about nine of the leading clinical people left the employ of the university. And since Father graduated there and I intended to graduate there, I was fearful that the next 2 years would be disrupted, so elected to transfer if I could so arrange it for my final 2 years.
I see.
I fortunately landed at Washington University.
How did you happen to choose Washington University?
My father had taken a graduate course here under Dr. McKim Marriott, and he thought very highly of this university.
I see.
So when I decided to transfer, I considered only Harvard and Washington, and fortunately Washington accepted me ahead, and I grabbed it and came here.
I see. That's very interesting. Do you remember any outstanding professors, either at Iowa or here, that you learned?
I remember vividly some at both schools. Naturally, since we're on this campus, I remember particularly those here. Mm-hmm. Dr. Graham had a tremendous influence upon my thinking, upon my life. Mm-hmm. Ernest Sachs was likewise a tremendously able teacher, and was not only a teacher, but both of these gentlemen were friends, and I retained that until their demise. I remember with affection Dr. Alexander, Dr. Barr, Dr. Marriott, Dr. Swartz, and half a dozen more of that same group, all of whom were superb teachers and gave us unusual number of hours in student-faculty relationship.
I see. Mm-hmm. So the faculty was not distant from the student body at that time.
I could not imagine a closer relationship that existed. These men met their lectures, they met their ward walks. Residents conducted almost none of these, and we saw the full professor or the associate professor on almost every occasion.
Mm-hmm.
It was a intimate, concentrated teaching experience.
And
it really was.
Mm-hmm. That's very interesting. Unfortunately, I don't believe it. It
no longer exists anywhere that I know.
Mm-hmm.
But we had a small class of 72. The university was a close-knit corporation at that time. I was privileged to live in as a substitute intern, taking the place of those who were ill about half of my senior year, which was then called being in-house. And it was a rare experience because you would go to school, but you carried on an intern's duties in the off hours and at night. And it was a rare privilege because I got to see how a busy hospital operates.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, the senior student did not do as much himself on the wards as he does today. So this was a great experience.
Mm-hmm. It must have been. Was there much competition between students?
I was not impressed with that. We were kind of a fraternity. Everybody was trying to help each other, and I did not sense that there was competition for honors, for AOA, for those various things. We were all struggling to pass, actually.
Mm-hmm. So the standards were high.
The standards were very high. There were 17 transfers in my group that came in at the junior year. We went through that entire junior year with an asterisk after our names on the roll, which meant that we were called upon with greater frequency than those names not so designated. Unfortunately, 8 of that 17 did not survive.
I see.
And they went to other schools to obtain their degree.
Mm-hmm. Why did you pick Montreal General Hospital for your internship?
Dr. Campbell Howard, whose father had been Osler's teacher, came from McGill to Iowa as professor of medicine, was a beloved and respected consultant and a good friend of my father. He then returned to McGill to become professor of medicine. And because of this relationship with three other former Iowans, I journeyed to McGill to take my internship.
I noticed the next year you were resident in pathology. Does that mean that you were considering other fields besides surgery?
Basically, I took a full year of pathology after my initial year of internship because in the English and the Canadian systems, you could not advance in residency without having a very extensive background in pathology. And
their
residents went through a year of path before going on to either advanced medical or surgical residencies.
I see. So you were 2 years then in...
I was 2 years at the Montreal General Hospital. That was one of the most valuable years of my entire experience because this was a 600-bed hospital that ran a 100% autopsy record consistently. And it was extremely active in a port city, and we saw a variety of things that I've never seen in any other institution.
Mm-hmm. The next step in your career, I noticed, was to accept a fellow in surgery in the University Hospital, University of Pennsylvania. How did this come about?
I was looking for advanced training in surgery because I decided this was what I wished to do. And in 1931, there were relatively limited numbers of places where one could go to get 3 or more years of training. Barnes Hospital presented such training. The Mayo Clinic presented such training. The Leahy Clinic did not. And relatively few of the university hospitals then had a full program. So I applied at Pennsylvania because at that time it was one of the named services. I went down there with 20 out of the original 200 who were candidates, and having made my interview, was certain that this was a waste of time because they never had taken a non-Pennsylvania graduate as a surgical fellow before, and there were only two openings. God was good to me, and I was fortunate to get one of those two, so I had my 3 subsequent years of training, which they called a fellow, but was really a residency at the university.
I see. I noticed that you have in your curriculum vitae that you were in the service of Eldridge Eliason.
Eldridge Eliason, who was a clinical professor of surgery at the university, had one of the 2 major surgical services along with Dr. George Mueller. There were only 2 general surgeons in a 600-bed hospital, so we had half of the general surgery and the other half was on the opposite service with 2 fellows on each service.
I see. How did you win the traveling fellow in surgery?
My chief wrote to Sir David Wilkie and arranged that I could go there. The only thing unfortunate about it, this was in the bottom of the Depression, so there was an appointment but no money.
I see.
And I was able to scrape together enough dollars to go to the Royal Infirmary in Edinburgh and get between 6 and 9 months of training under Sir David Wilkie, who was at that time one of the great general surgeons in the British Empire.
Mm-hmm. What did you do after you came back to the United States?
I was looking for some place to go to work. The Depression was still on. I was a Midwesterner. No universities were hiring because of lack of money, so I elected to go to a Midwestern city that had a medical school where I hopefully might work, and elected Omaha because it had in the University of Nebraska Medical School.
I see.
They were good enough to give me a spot where I could work 5 mornings a week for nothing, but I had a very active surgical experience for those first years when one was struggling to establish a practice.
I see. And I noticed you advanced through the ranks from instructor to professor to senior consultant at the University of Nebraska Medical Center.
That is correct. At age 65, one gives up your professorship and becomes a senior consultant if you are still actively teaching, which I happen to be.
Now, since you mentioned teaching, what kind of teaching did you do over these years?
Early on, I carried a full lectures schedule at the university.
You did.
And ward walks there. In more recent years, as our classes have increased from 72 to 150, we carry on a very heavy teaching program in the private hospitals. I am the director of the teaching program in the Nebraska Methodist Hospital, where we have about 20 medical students and on surgery and 2 surgical residents on rotation. And our teaching is with them. We present to them a whole set of conferences, path conferences, etc., which is part of their surgical education.
I see. Did you specialize in any one branch of surgery, or were you a general surgeon?
I have been all my life a general surgeon. Early on, I was very interested in pediatric surgery.
I see.
And when we opened our children's hospital, I was chief of that division and learned pediatric surgery the hard way by doing it, because there were no pediatric surgeons at that time.
I see.
I carried that on for about 15 years until we got a trained pediatric surgeon, and I relinquished it then to his care.
I see.
That's why a lot of early publications are in pediatric surgery.
Yes, I noticed you list your publications as over 100. You are too modest to send me the first 2 pages of your bibliography, and I'm a little curious as to what is on them. Were most of these in pediatric surgery?
A lot of those were in pediatrics. And
here's page 3.
In this, most of the early ones were in pediatric surgery, and then these in the Navy Bulletin were during the war years when I was writing about some of the interesting things that we were encountering. it was in trauma and in PED mostly the first 2 years.
I see. Perhaps this is a good time to talk about your Navy career. I noticed that you had active duty in the U.S. Naval Reserve starting in 1942 to 1946, that you were Chief of Surgery at the Great Lakes Train Station and Chief of Surgery at the U.S. Naval Hospital in Texas and on the aircraft carrier USS Essex CV-9 flagship. What type of surgery did you do during these years? Was it combat wounds?
The first year at Great Lakes was all reparative surgery. This
I
was
see.
In the first year of the war, and I was at a place called McIntyre Dispensary, named for the Surgeon General, Ross McIntyre.
I see.
This was one of his darlings, and we had a 500-bed surgical unit there in which we repaired hernias, hydroceles, hemorrhoids, circumcisions, everything that the recruit needed fixed when he came in the service.
Mm-hmm.
At that time, that base had 3,000 new recruits in every night, and we shipped 3,000 to the fleet every night. So they stayed on the base from 3 weeks to 6 weeks, during which time we repaired those things that they needed done. This was the nature of that. I did 1,500 hernias there in 9 months.
That's amazing.
And about 500 acute appendices. At Corpus Christi, I was chief of surgery there. That was a standard naval hospital with the run-of-the-mill that you would see in any base, air base, with about 35,000 people.
Mm-hmm.
The service on the aircraft carrier, I was surgeon on that for the last 19 months of the war. There was some trauma that occurred on the ship. Relatively little combat, except the one time that we were hit with a kamikaze, because in naval warfare, it's usually all or none for the pilots.
Mm-hmm.
If they're hit, they don't come home.
Mm-hmm.
You have relatively few wounded.
Mm-hmm.
But you do have a sizable city, and that there are 3,500 men on one of those carriers.
Mm-hmm.
There are lots of accidents that happen.
Yes.
There are acute appendices, there
mm-hmm.
are hernias, there are
mm-hmm.
all sorts of things happen to them.
Mm-hmm. I noticed when you were discharged with the rank of commander and was awarded 7 battle stars, presidential unit citation, and personal Navy citation from Admiral Richard Spruance, commander of the Pacific Fleet. Was this your experience in during World War II? After World War II, I noticed you were designated as the first honorary consultant in surgery to Strategic Air Command. What did this involve?
When I came home from the Navy, the Air Force had just been severed from the Army. And instead of being the Army Air Force, as it was all during World War II, it suddenly became the United States Air Force. In Omaha was established the headquarters of the Strategic Air Command,
mm-hmm.
which is our offensive weapon in case of war.
Mm-hmm.
It controls all of the bombers. It controls all of the submarine offensive warfare with missiles, and it controls all of the ground missiles which would be used for offense. They established this base here, but the Air Force had no established medical department at first. I was asked to cover the surgical end
mm-hmm.
of the headquarters, Strategic Air Command, which I did completely for 5 years, and then have remained their consultant to the present.
I see. Mm-hmm.
Later on, I became General Surgical Consultant, one of the General Surgical Consultants to the United States Air Force, and I still am in that position.
I see. What does that involve?
That basically involves visiting various Air Force hospitals, meeting with the surgical residents,
mm-hmm.
seeing patients with them, conducting educational exercises, and evaluating them for the Surgeon General.
I see. Mm-hmm. Among your awards and positions, there's one that I'm not sure I can pronounce, King Aksarben.
King Aksarben.
Oh, King Aksarben.
That is Nebraska spelled backwards.
Oh, it is. And with the Roman numeral 71.
Aksarben is an organization in Omaha which embraces western Iowa and all Nebraska. It was founded as a business organization, but it is now agricultural, business, educational, and philanthropic. We have 60,000 members who pay a $20 membership fee. We operate the Aksarben Track, which has a 90-day season. Aksarben, in addition to its funds from membership, makes about $2 million a year, which is given to charity in Omaha and in Nebraska and western Iowa. Mm-hmm. Annually, they have a Aksarben Ball, which is comparable to your Vale Prophets Ball,
I see.
Or mm-hmm. the Mardi Gras.
Mm-hmm.
A king is selected from the community who has been presumably a mm-hmm. prominent citizen, mm-hmm. and the queen is the daughter of a prominent family.
I see.
They reign in the court for a year.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned a track. Is this a...
The racetrack.
Racetrack.
We have about 2,000 horses there right now.
I see.
It's one of the better tracks in the mm-hmm. whole Midwest.
Mm-hmm. I noticed you also received the Governor's Meritorious Service Award in 1973. The fourth citizen in the state of Nebraska to receive this honor. Do you care to comment on that?
For one reason or another, the governor elected to, a Democratic governor gave this to me as a Republican for apparently service in medicine to the state.
I see. That's very nice. I noticed that you also have the Distinguished Service to Medicine Award from the University of Nebraska Medical Center and have been on the board of directors of the Omaha Chamber of Commerce, the Omaha Symphony Board, and a member President's Council. What is the President's Council?
The President's Council is a council of people in the state of Nebraska who meet four or five times a year with the President of the University of Nebraska, who are his agents in that we are briefed on the functioning and the position of the university and are hopefully able to transmit through multiple groups of private citizens the problems of the university and aid its consideration by the legislature on which it's dependent for funds.
I see. Mm-hmm. I notice you've also been very active in professional organizations in Nebraska and nationwide. In 1974 and 1975, you were elected the president of the American College of Surgeons, but this only came after a long series of offices held with them. Would you care to tell us something about the American College of Surgeons and membership requirements and what it tries to do?
The American College of Surgeons is the largest surgical organization in this country with some 40,000+ members. Membership requires a minimum of 5 years training with certification in your board of surgery, an ethical record which must withstand critical evaluation to become a fellow of the college. It is dedicated to improving the care of the surgical patient in the United States. Its great contribution early on was the establishment of the first system for inspecting American hospitals, which it undertook in 1910 and carried on for 30 years alone.
It did.
Until the JCAH, or the Joint Commission on Hospital Accreditation, took it over when the burden financially became so great that the college could no longer carry it on. Today, we're the greatest educational body in American surgery. With our clinical congress, our sectional meetings in the spring and fall, CSAP, which is a great ongoing educational exercise which is put out every year or two by the college and which most all of our people take to remain current in their field.
What is CSAP? Is it an exam?
It is a large compend with about 200 or 300 questions
with
five possible answers, all of which are good, put together by a group of 70 dedicated surgeons who work about 18 months to make each exam, and then there is a compend at the end which gives you the correct answer and the reason why that is the correct answer. It is a superb educational exercise that covers all of the general branches of surgery.
That sounds very important, and as a means of keeping up the skills of doctors who have been graduated in past years. Is that compulsory to the membership?
It is not compulsory. Although certification in general surgery after 1980 will be limited for a 10-year period, and then you will have to have some form of recertification.
Those
of us certified prior to 1980 have no limitation on our certificate.
Mm-hmm.
The type of examination specifically which will be given to those people in the future has not yet been decided.
I see.
And it is still being discussed at high levels.
So the certification will begin for new surgeons in 1980.
Well, we are all certified, but those who will take the board for the first time in 1980 and be certified will have a 10-year span on their certificate.
I see.
And then they will have to rejuvenate it
to
be recertified. Those prior to 1980, of whom, of course, I took it in the second group in which it was given, board, in 1940, we have ours in perpetuity.
I see. Mm-hmm. And now they'll be limited to a 10-year span.
After 1980. Uh-huh.
Do you think this is a good idea?
It's discussed. Mm-hmm. Some fields feel it is not in being required as a requirement.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure that this will hold as an absolute requirement.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you see, it's almost 11 years off before that would become effective.
Mm-hmm.
And I think great changes will happen in that time.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure that there will be more and more graduate work going on, which there is today.
Mm-hmm.
But whether or not you will be forced to go through a specific recertification process, I think is still debatable.
Mm-hmm. I noticed that you were elected by the American College of Surgeons as their representative to the Council of Medical Specialty Societies, and that you held this position from 1971 to 1976. What sort of topics were discussed at these meetings?
This is an organization of the 22 specialty groups or designated groups, including family practice. Membership on the board of the CMSS, the Council of Medical Specialty Societies, is permitted one member on the board for every 5,000 members in the specialty. So if you had 30,000 members in family practice, you could have six members in the coordinating council. They meet four times a year to discuss common problems of medicine in so-called specialties. We deal with the multiplicity of things from training to government problems, etc.
And you are now on the executive committee, first vice president of this organization?
I'm no longer on it. I have finally graduated from that.
Uh-huh.
Although the president of that right now is a gentleman on this campus, Dr. Tom Ferguson, who is in thoracic surgery here at Barnes.
Mm-hmm.
And he's doing a very able job, incidentally.
From 1973 to 1976, you served on the Interspecialty Advisory Board of the AMA. What did this involve?
That's a similar group that sponsored by the American Medical Association to give specialists an input into the AMA. Actually, it is a sounding board for the AMA officers to tell representatives of specialties what they are doing, etc. It has really no major function.
I see. You have published an amazing number of articles during your career. Now, would you consider what yourself a clinical member of the faculty, or were you on the full-time staff of the faculty? These seem to be the divisions here at Washington University, and I'm trying to place you in one or the other, I guess.
I'm definitely in the clinical group.
In the clinical group.
We have just adopted that designation in our school.
I see.
We have not used it until right now. I happen to be serving on the committee that is bringing in that recommendation. And if I lived in the succeeding 30 years, I would have been clinical professor.
I see.
I would have been clinical associate professor. I have never received any money from the university for 45 years of teaching. Mm-hmm. It's all been gratis.
For all that work. That's very interesting. I would say that you have published much more than most clinical doctors find time to do, and your publications seem to be in almost every field of surgery. I did notice in the present you have specialized or have shown a great interest in the treatment of cancer. Is that right?
My basic interest the last 15 years have been breast cancer.
In breast cancer.
I'm interested in gastric cancer and colon cancer, but my principal interest has been in breast cancer.
Okay.
And I have been in practice. I've published in this field.
Mm-hmm.
We have quite a sizable series of these in our private practice that I have followed now for 30 years.
I see.
Carrying the follow-up at home, or doing it in after hours at home, because we did not, at that early on, have a hospital system of a good follow-up.
Mm-hmm.
We now have that on the computer, and it makes it very easily, but easy. But I did it over a period of 30 years by writing to the doctors, over half of whom are now dead, writing to family, writing to priests, writing to ministers, writing to grocers, writing to sheriffs, anything to follow these people.
Mm-hmm.
But it's been a fascinating work.
Yes, I think that was the results of that work that you published in the American Journal of Surgery?
Yes, just recently.
In August of 78. Could you tell us briefly the results of your study?
Well, we have found that we still see almost one quarter of the people in Nebraska are advanced when we first see them.
Nice.
They're advanced by strict clinical criteria.
Mm-hmm.
if you take the overall survival, it's a little over 60% 5-year survival. If we take all comers, if we have them selective, it's about 85% 5-year survival. There are about 90,000 new cases of breast cancer in the United States each year. There are about 33,000 deaths in the United States each year from breast cancer. Of our people, we find that of those who have cancer, about 70% of them will succumb to their breast cancer ultimately, if you take 200 of them consecutively.
Mm-hmm.
About 20% will die of some other medical condition. Of course, heart and stroke are the two most common. And about 9.8% will die of a second independent malignancy, a second unrelated cancer. If a woman is going to get recurrence in our area, and by the way, the average age in Nebraska is 69 when she gets a tumor, she's not a young girl, the average age. If she's going to get a recurrence, we will see 70% of them within the first 5 years. We will see another 18% in the second 5 years. Mm-hmm. So that if they make 10 years after their mastectomy and initial treatment, she has a relatively small chance of developing a recurrence from that cancer, but she still has an 8% chance of developing cancer on the other side.
I see. What treatment do you recommend for cancer of the breast?
We still believe that in the operable cases, a modified radical mastectomy is a treatment of choice. We only use radiation therapy if they have more than 4 axillary nodes involved. My work suggests to me that an appraisal of the axillary nodes is one of the very important things in doing an axillary dissection, because if they have less than 4 nodes, they have twice as good a chance of survival as if they have more than 4 involved nodes. Mm-hmm. We only radiate those that have 4 or more nodes. I use no chemotherapy in the postmenopausal patients prophylactically, but I do use it in the younger ones, the premenopausal ones, because it is only in this group that experience all over the country has shown it to be of value.
I see. Mm-hmm. I notice you have written articles on these subjects, and that there has been a controversy between those advocating total mastectomy and those advocating what you call it, a limited mastectomy.
Yes.
Or a simple mastectomy.
I just don't believe that they are correct, mm-hmm. because I'm convinced from our own experience that doing a axillary dissection with a mastectomy removes tumor, and that's the name of the game when you're dealing with cancer. Mm-hmm. Second is the most important single prognostic thing we have on telling you how that patient's going to do, and helps you to delineate their subsequent therapy.
Mm-hmm.
I admit this is controversial. There are some fine clinics that would disagree, but after all, one must live by what their own experience tells them.
And you have done a lot of consecutive long-term study-ups. I noticed this one in 1968, a report of 375 consecutive patients with long-term follow-ups.
And we're now at 650.
You're now at 650. And
with the long-term follow-up.
And perhaps you could just restate again what, now that you're at, you said 600 and...
We are now about 650 cases.
650. Perhaps you could just restate at this point then the results of this follow-up.
The follow-up still shows that about 60% will be alive at the end of 5 years if you take all comers. If you take the selected ones with small tumors seen early, there'll be about 80 to 85% alive. But we include in ours those that are advanced, those that are aged, those that are tremendously big tumors, and we still see about a quarter of them that should have been in much earlier.
I see. I have an article here entitled "What to Inspect in Cancer of the Pancreas."
Bad news is a principal thing, because it is one of the cancers that is increasing in frequency nationally.
Yes.
Cancer of the stomach is getting less frequent.
I see.
Breast is increasing.
Mm-hmm.
Ovary is increasing. Stomach is decreasing.
I see.
Pancreas is gradually increasing.
Mm-hmm.
It is a bad tumor in anybody's hands. It is silent early on. Our diagnostic methods, while improved, are still not accurate.
Mm-hmm.
Our therapy is most discouraging.
I see. What do you attribute to the fact that in some areas cancer is increasing, like the pancreas, and I believe you said the stomach is decreasing?
Because nobody can really answer why these things happen.
Mm-hmm.
There is the trend today is increasing evidence that environment has much to do with malignancy.
I see.
People are beginning to study this more and more, and obviously your recovery is dependent tremendously on inherent resistance to that tumor.
Mm-hmm.
This is well established, except we don't know how to measure it yet.
Mm-hmm.
But we do know that individual resistance determines much how well you'll do. And we also know that environment has a tremendous amount to do with the instance of malignancy.
I believe in one of your articles you illustrated the idea of individual resistance to disease. And this woman in the Middle East had contracted another disease, which made her less resistant to cancer, and as a result had a recurrence. Am I stating that right, or how would you
certain,
put that?
Certain things undoubtedly will decrease a patient's resistance to cancer, although we can't measure.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, a great tragedy in a family will very often be accompanied by a subsequent recurrence of malignancy. It happens more often than just chance would seem to dictate. We can't measure that, but we see that happen so frequently that one day we will know how to measure a patient's resistance. There's a tremendous amount of work being done on the lymphocytic series and what it has to do with individual patients' resistance to tumor and susceptibility to tumor, but we're still walking in a great morass of fog. But I hope the next generation will unravel this, and there's some wonderful minds working on it.
In April 1970, you published an article about bile duct exploration. What is your thinking on, as you're thinking on that change?
We reviewed these common bile duct explorations on a series of, 1500 or 1600 consecutive gallbladders.
I see.
And we outlined what things we thought dictated opening the common bile duct. We found that in about 25%, we felt it necessary to explore the common bile duct. And our instance of stones was recorded. It's relatively low when you explore that many.
I see.
About a year after this, we started doing routine table cholangiograms, namely taking an x-ray of this duct to see whether there were stones in it and see if we needed to open them.
Mm-hmm.
You might ask, well, why didn't you do that earlier? Why didn't people do that 15 or 20 years ago? And there's a very good reason for it. Our anesthetics at that time were explosive, and you couldn't bring an x-ray machine safely into the operating room, nor could you use the actual cautery in the operating room, because a spark might blow your patient up and you with them.
I see.
It was only when we got non-inflammable anesthetics that we could use the cautery for hemostasis and bring an x-ray machine into the operating room. We now do table cholangiography on almost every patient, take an x-ray and decide whether we need to open the common duct. We have reduced our instance of exploration from 25% to 10% and quadrupled our take on stones when we do look in now, because we know they're there, we've seen them.
Mm-hmm.
We're publishing a follow-up paper for that this year.
I see.
Covering another almost 500 patients done with table cholangiograms.
In 1960, you published what seems to me a very important paper. I'm not sure that I understand it all, but perhaps you could explain the significance of it.
We were and continue to be convinced that there is a certain pattern seen in some women's breasts when you biopsy them,
mm-hmm.
for so-called fibrocystic disease, that suggests that that is a potentially dangerous breast to develop cancer. Fibrocystic disease is a very common thing in women's breasts. Over half of them have some degree of it. It's a little shoddiness, a little irregularity, some cyst formation, incident to the constant changes in that breast in the menstrual cycle, which goes on from puberty to the menopause in the female. We noticed in doing a large number of biopsies in fibrocystic disease that there was a small group, perhaps 10%, that showed a very marked activity of the cells, a piling up of the cells, evidence of stimulation, which not only was two or three layers, but filled a whole duct. Now, if that broke through the duct, that's cancer. If it just filled the duct, it's still localized. And we call that precancerous epithelial hyperplasia. When I published this paper, or when it was first given at the Southern Surgical in 1960, it was received with some skepticism. A great many people didn't believe this was true because they felt that fibrocystic disease was a safe entity. I am happy to tell you that a great many people, including Dr. Warren Cole from this school and others, now believe with us that there is a very definite relationship between this hyperplasia and cancer. We've been also interested in malignancy in other organs, including the pancreas, which we just discussed, and in cancer of the thyroid, which is reasonably common in our area. Yes, fortunately, it has a much better prognosis, except for the small cell type, which is hopeless always, fortunately makes up less than 10% of them. Mm. But the papillary and the papillary follicular types of carcinoma of the thyroid, which are seen quite frequently in young people, have a very excellent prognosis. And our series has done very well. As a matter of fact, we've only had a small number of deaths, and that is in those people who are much older when they first got their papillary carcinoma. It is a pretty good cancer if you have to get one.
I see.
Because it can be handled quite well surgically. Colon cancer, we have a great interest in that today because it is increasing in its frequency, and it involves both sexes, and it is the male's most common tumor.
I see.
After breast and uterus and cervix, it is the female's most common cancer, so it has a very wide interest. Colon cancer is triply interesting because it's one, it's increasing in this country a great deal. Two, it's a very insidious tumor that doesn't show up, doesn't have very many symptoms until often is quite advanced. Three, it probably is environmental in some respects in its origin, because it's a very interesting thing that the African native are those peoples who eat a tremendous bulk diet and have three or four bulky stools per day almost never get cancer of the colon.
I see.
While in this country where we subsist on concentrated foods and the small fecal output, cancer of the colon is increasing dramatically, and that's true in all the countries in the world that live on concentrated foods.
This
may be a factor. I doubt if we'll go to the other, but it may give us some etiology, some thoughts on etiology.
And then I think the search starts with your latest article, and then to work backwards, do you have comments on these others?
Cancer of the pancreas, as I said before, is most discouraging. We presented 100 consecutive patients that we had seen in our private practice. They were most discouraging. We had almost no long-term survivals. With radical resection of the Whipple type, we had 1 6-year survival and 1 3-year survival out of about 8 very radical procedures. The balance, all were palliative procedures, and the average expectancy is about 9 months after surgery, max. It is a very distressing operation. Cancer of the breast. That was a pancreatic thing. I think that covers those pretty well.
Okay, let's see, that's 8, 1, 2. I guess this is the last one.
Carcinoma of the gallbladder and the extrahepatic bile ducts. I was interested in that because the first paper I wrote while a resident in Path at McGill was on tumors of the extrahepatic bile ducts. And I went back in all of those extensive records of the Montreal General Hospital, and I found 4 patients at that time with extrahepatic bile duct tumors. Interestingly enough, I reread some of the protocols of Sir William Osler, who as a young man had been a pathologist in the same department, and these were handwritten path protocols in Osler's handwriting that I went back over. That historically was fascinating to me. These are bad tumors today, both gallbladder and bile duct tumors. Relatively few of them ever survive. Only cancers of the gallbladder, the only ones that survive are those that you find incidentally and have a very small one that you take out not suspecting it. When you have an obvious big cancer of the gallbladder, even with hepatic resection, the results are very, very poor. Large benign gastric ulcers. This was a fascinating study of gastric ulcers 3 centimeters or above. That's an ulcer over 1.5 inches to 12 centimeters or 3 inches in diameter. We found a sizable number of these and we reported them. Some of them are benign, a surprising number of them are both benign or malignant. They're about half and half separated. The point I was making in this is that when you operate upon these and you look at them and you have them in your hands, some of them are very difficult to tell whether they're malignant or benign. Even with the initial microscopic sections, they're hard to tell. We found that we were wrong both ways, saying they were benign and they were malignant, or they were malignant and they were benign in 24%, both ways, in a quarter of them. In other words, you couldn't tell till you got your final sections through. That's more on breast, infancy, and childhood. I don't want to discuss that anymore. I've been out of it too long.
Are there any other areas of surgery you'd like to discuss?
Well, at this stage in the game, I don't believe so. I think that I'm most interested now in the future of how medicine is going to go, because I think that we're at the threshold of some great changes. I believe that the dramatic growth in our hospital system has reached its zenith and is going to begin to taper down. In other words, lesser number of people will be hospitalized in the future than there are today, and much more will be done on an outpatient basis of one kind or another.
I see.
This is going to be come about by economic prodding. I think that there's a sizable amount of the work today that is done in hospital can and will be done in an extra hospital setting.
I
adjacent
see.
To and utilizing hospital facilities, but not being admitted. I would guess that maybe a quarter of the patients that we see in the hospital will be handled outside. I'm sure this is true in surgery. And economically, it will save whatever the per diem is per bed. It's $105 in our hospital. I'm sure it's in Barnes, it's probably $130. I don't know. But it'll be higher. And this is going to be one of the great trends, I am convinced, as we go along. We're also making every effort in medicine and in surgery today to curtail costs in taking care of a given problem by more critically looking at what we must do to arrive at the same amount of information. In other words, not do everything on everybody, but in a much more a selective method, work up a patient in effort to reduce its cost, because the costs are horrendous. Hospital costs in America went up 15% in 77. In 78, they went up 12.6%. This year, we hope to hold them at 11.6%, but in the first 3 months, they've gone up 14.6%, basically because both food and fuel in the same period went up 14.1%. We can't control this. We have to buy energy and we have to buy food. So until the federal government and the administration can make some dent in the overall inflation, you're not going to see much happen in hospital costs.
Do you see any other trends in medicine?
Well, of course, the most striking thing is the tremendous number of people going into family practice today. I think many more are going into it than will stay in it, but that's only an impression. I do not believe that this will satisfy nearly as many as are starting in training. I've watched this over a period of years, and I think that you'll find an increasing, a sizable number of those people who have taken a basic training in family practice, finding that it does not quite satisfy them, and mm-hmm. and going into some specific specialty. Because medicine is such a big entity, mm-hmm. it is so complex, it is so demanding, that the ability of one person to keep even reasonably current in that broader spectrum is almost impossible.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think that the idea of specialization is dead
mm-hmm.
simply because 50% of people have to be in primary practice today because of primary medicine, because the government said so.
Mm-hmm.
And they now say 60%.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what they say and what happens doesn't necessarily follow.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. McLaughlin, could you tell us something about your family?
I am married to Beatrice Reimers, a Nebraska girl, and I'm very much in love with her after 40 years. We have one son who lives in Chicago. He works for Crown & Zellerbach Paper Company out of San Francisco, and he is in industrial sales, traveling the eastern half of the United States in their TabGuard division. We lost a second son some 10 years ago in a car accident. We have a happy family, and we live in Omaha, and we just built a new townhouse, which has been a delight in the last year or so.
Are you still in actively practicing surgery, or have...
I am still carrying a full surgical schedule.
Mm-hmm.
I don't operate nearly as much
mm-hmm.
as I did
mm-hmm.
10 years or
mm-hmm.
or 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But I go to the hospital each day when I'm in the city, and that's most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
I have two very able associates
mm-hmm.
who are carrying an increasing amount of the load.
Mm-hmm.
I have a consultant practice that I'm in the office 4 days per week.
Mm-hmm.
I spend the month of July in northern Minnesota, where we have a summer place.
Mm-hmm. Where in northern Minnesota? I have
just south of Bemidji.
I see.
Between Bemidji and Park Rapids,
yes.
In the Paul Bunyan Forest.
Yes, I know where that is.
You know
is.
That area?
Yes, I
We're
do.
On Lake Mantrap.
Mm-hmm. That sounds very nice. When you talk to a surgeon, it's usually malpractice fees insurance comes up. What has been your experience with the cost of malpractice insurance?
Of course, it escalated very rapidly about 3-4 years ago,
mm-hmm.
and hit its peak in our area.
I see.
Ours are now going down somewhat. Probably because of a little better experience with the settlement.
I see.
Ours peaked out about 3 years ago, and ours, our surgical cost in our office is down about 20% from 3 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I am hopeful that it will continue to improve, but it's never going to go away.
I see.
I'm
mm-hmm.
sure of that.
Mm-hmm. Dr. McLaughlin, you were comparing Washington University Medical School and to other medical schools while in the period while you were a student here. Could you tell us a little bit more about that?
I would like to answer that in the context of what is my most vivid impression after 50 years of this school, where I was privileged to be a student for 2 years. Coming from a very fine medical school, namely University of Iowa in Iowa City, I found a tremendous difference in Washington University, because at that time, while it was a relatively small school with only 72 in my class and a similar number in the other classes, it had developed an international reputation which was shared perhaps only by Hopkins, Harvard, perhaps Michigan, and very few other schools. During that 2 years, there was a constant procession of brilliant young people from Scotland, from England, from France, from Germany, from the Far East, coming through various divisions. I remember particularly those that came through the surgical division to visit Dr. Graham and Kofor's clinic. But the same thing was true in pediatrics under Dr. Marriott, the same thing in OBGYN under Dr. Schwartz and his group, the same thing was true in radiology under Sherwood Moore, Larimore, and those people, And the same thing was true with Ernest Sachs and Clemmy, his right hand at that time. It rather opened one's eyes to the fact that medicine was a fantastic field that involved the whole world, and there were great people and competent people all over the world, but they would come to those special centers to pick up the things that were being developed, and they certainly were being developed at Washington at that time. For this, I owe a very particular debt to this university, which I gratefully acknowledge.
Well, we want to thank you very much for taking time to give us this interview and for the interesting things you said in it.